Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The U.S. Coast Guard continues searching for the Emmy Rose, a Maine-based ground fishing boat. Four fishermen are missing after the boat sank 20 miles off the coast of Provincetown. For an update on the search, we are joined by Petty Officer Ryan Noel with the U.S. Coast Guard. Petty Officer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Nice to meet you.
What is the latest on the search?
Currently, we are still searching for the four fishermen from the Emmy Rose. We have two assets out there actively searching. That is the Coast Guard cutter Vigorous and also an HC-144 Ocean Sentry out of Air Station Cape Cod.
So I know there's a lot we don't know. We don't want to speculate on what we don't know, but can you tell us what the Coast Guard has learned to this point about what happened to the Emmy Rose?
As of right now, we're still unsure as to what have happened. We just know that we're actively searching. And when we got the call yesterday morning at around 1:30 a.m., we got their EPIRB. It was an emergency position indicating radio beacon. We got the message, and we got assets out there on scene within an hour to check out what's going on. And we came upon debris and an empty life raft. And from there, we got additional assets to assist in the search.
And is this a small boat, a large boat?
The Emmy Rose is actually an 82-foot dragger. Its home port is out of Portland, Maine.
So we're deeply concerned about the missing fishermen. Our thoughts are with them. How often does the Coast Guard respond to these types of emergencies?
Well, this is actually the first big search we've gotten like this in some time. But regardless of whatever happens, the Coast Guard will always respond to any type of Mayday, emergency position indicating radio beacon or EPIRB, phone call, anything like that. We'll always be trained up and ready to respond.
When you refer to it as a big search, what does that mean to you? Is that the size and scope of the search or the import of the search? How should we think about that?
Well, as of just 11:30 this morning, we've actually been searching for about 36 hours here with a coverage of about approximately 1,500 square miles. We've had multiple assets in this search, such as, like I mentioned before, who is active, the Coast Guard cutter Vigorous, the Coast Guard cutter Key Largo, a couple 60s or helicopters from Air Station Cape Cod, as well as the HC-144 Ocean Sentry. And also, we even have Station Provincetown out there assisting. So we just try to get as many assets out there to assist, to help in the search as we can, looking for these four fishermen.
And what are your next steps?
Our next steps are just to continue searching. Just going to keep doing what we can to stay out there on the water and keep looking for these fishermen, hopefully bring them back home to their families.
Well, that is what we hope for, too. Petty Officer Ryan Noel of the U.S. Coast Guard, we are wishing you the best of luck with the search. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. You have a good day.
So as we continue to hope for the fishermen's rescue, let's check in with their community. Joining us now is Ben Martins, Executive Director of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. Ben Martins, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, as I understand it, the Emmy Rose is not part of what's called your sector. It's part of the sustainable harvest sector of cooperative fishing vessels. The leader of that sector didn't want to comment while the search is ongoing. I appreciate you giving us your time. I understand Maine commercial fishing is a small community. So how's the community holding up today?
Yeah, there's a lot of anxiety within the community today. And, unfortunately, we've had to deal with these types of losses in the past. And so it always brings up raw emotions. It always has a lot of hope and fear for the families that are going through these types of crises. I think that there's a lot of fear, a lot of worry, and still some hope. Everybody's holding out hope still.
Commercial fishing is one of the most dangerous jobs in the U.S. It is striking that the Emmy Rose was out fishing to put food on people's plates, given that this is a week that is focused on feasting and gratitude. So how does the community support the fishermen's families right now and what they're going through?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the family and what they need and the space that they need. But, I think we all hope that they're getting the space that they need, they're getting the respect that they need, and that they're not alone. We lost our board chairman last January at sea, and it was just heartbreaking to watch the family go through the search and rescue process, but they really needed their friends and community there to support them, because there's more questions than answers. You just talk to the Coast Guard and they don't have a lot of answers right now, and a lot of times it's those questions of what happened, where they are in the search, and what comes next that just weigh heavily on a family, on a community, on an entire industry right now.
Ben, you just mentioned the painful loss of the chairman of your organization. That was Joe Nickerson. A member of his crew, Chris Pinkham, also died after the boat capsized back in January. What steps do we need to take to increase safety for commercial fishermen?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different pieces to that equation. And first and foremost is, we have fishermen that they're fishing under dangerous circumstances. And a lot of times they're fishing at times when they're trying to get the best price for their fish. And that can be through bad weather. That can be through bad circumstances. And so I hope that everybody, when they are buying fish, when they are sourcing their fish, they're remembering that there's people out there that are doing that hard work to bring it home, and that it is a dangerous job. It's something that fishermen obviously love and care deeply about, but there's risks. And the price that we pay for our fish is not just what we pay for at the counter. And so I really hope that we all remember that, and that we're willing to pay a good price for the fish, so that we don't have to have people feel as though they're being forced to take unnecessary risks at times.
Ben, is there anything else you want us to know as we all continue to hope and pray for a successful rescue of the four fishermen from the Emmy Rose?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only other thing that we would love to just share for those within the fishing community is that, after we went through our tragic loss last year, it became pretty clear that the fishing community didn't have the support structure within it to always get those of us in the community, the fishermen, their families, the help that they need when it came to mental health. So we actually have a program that we set up last year that's funded, where if individuals are looking for counseling, if they're willing to take that step, we have funding available to pay for that. And so one of the reasons why I agreed to talk is we really want to share that opportunity with the fishing community. It doesn't have to be those that are directly connected to the boat. Everybody goes through these types of crises in their own heads when it happens. And so if somebody's struggling, we want them to know that there's a program out there, and they can go to our website to find details about how they can access those resources for the fishing community.
And that's Ben Martins, Executive Director of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. Our thoughts are with your community, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're welcoming back to the show Gerald Walker, who's a professor of creative writing at Emerson College. You might recall our conversation with him from a few years ago about his memoir, The World in Flames, A Black Boyhood in a White Supremacist Doomsday Cult. Now, Walker's latest collection of essays will sit you right down with its power and its clarity. He tells stories of his life as a Black parent, teacher, writer, husband in America. It is full of humor, love, pain, and a very clear message of resilience. The collection is How to Make a Slave, and it was a National Book Award finalist. Professor Walker, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me back, Tiziana.
So in reading this collection, it felt to me like it is about a lifetime, and that it was the work of a lifetime. Is it? Was it a lifetime of work for you to get here?
Well, it certainly was at least 15 years of writing. The oldest essay, I think I wrote it back in 2006, and the most recent one I wrote in 2020. So it's been 15 years worth of material, but the content certainly spans 50 years of my life.
When you wrote the first essay, were you working towards a collection, or what, did each of these essays sort of stand alone as you wrote them?
Everyone was a standalone essay. I simply get moved by a notion, and I want to explore it on the page, and I write an essay, and then I send it out and try to publish it. And it never occurred to me to sit down and write a collection of essays from start to finish. I simply wrote them and assembled them.
So that's really striking, because I got to tell you, you put them all together, they tell a story. So is that coincidental, or did you heavily curate which ones you put into this book? I mean, this is a story of a man becoming a man, and it seems being at peace with the man he is.
I think it probably speaks to the fact that writers and perhaps all people have certain preoccupations, and we have themes that we return to over and over and over again. And until maybe we reach some resolution, we grapple with them to try to see what we can make of why they plague us so. So I think that I come back to certain themes over and over again, and that's why the collection is cohesive, despite the fact that they were written very separately.
So let's dive into the content a little. You know, every word in the book feels carefully chosen, and I know the title was in the title essay, How to Make a Slave. Can you explain the significance of the title for us?
Sure. The title is from a famous quote from Frederick Douglass. Right before he is about to fight and beat up his master because he's simply had enough, he says, "You have seen how a man was made a slave. You shall see how a slave was made a man." And that's the moment in the narrative when he simply rises up and no longer will allow himself to be treated less than a human.
Is that the first essay you wrote?
No, that's probably midway through the collection. I think I wrote that essay in 2014.
Do you remember which was the first one you wrote, and can you tell us about it?
Sure. The very first one is Dragon Slayers, and it's a tribute to my professor at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, James Allen McPherson. It was the first attempt of me being an essayist. My MFA degree from Iowa is in fiction writing. And after laboring as a fiction writer quite unsuccessfully for, about 15 years, my wife said, "Why don't you try nonfiction? Because all of your stories are thinly veiled stories from your actual life. All you do is change names and locations. So just try to write a true story and see if that will make a difference." And I refused to do it. And she kept plaguing me until finally I gave in and said, okay, I'll write one. I wrote Dragon Slayers. I sent it out. It was accepted for publication, my first publication. And it then was selected for Best American Essays the following year. So from that point forward, I've been an essayist.
Then you need to listen to her, clearly.
I know. That's funny. That's what she said.
So one of the things that's really striking about that essay, right? So James Allen McPherson, as you said, the first Black writer to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. You sort of try to call him out one-on-one. And I feel the nightmare unfolding as that story unfolds. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I definitely tried to call him out, but it was a calling out in response to being called out. I was in his class, and he was about to have my piece workshop discussed by my peers. And he, before he allowed the discussion to begin, he prefaced the class comments by saying that a lot of Black rappers are selling out their race by using stereotypes in their material, but these are not the lives these people actually live. And they're frauds, these artists. And then he held up my story and said, "This writer is doing the exact same thing." And that devastated me. I couldn't believe it because I had just become acquainted with his work the summer before that workshop. And I saw him as my literary model, and I idolized him. And the very first meeting we had in class was for him to accuse me of doing what I thought at the time, and even now, is probably one of the greatest sins a Black person can do, which is to trade their race for some personal gain.
Do you feel like that's what you were doing? And how did you journey from there? That is harsh, harsh criticism.
Yes. I was not doing it intentionally. I was simply a new writer who had some volatile material, and I was incapable of handling it. So I didn't know what I was doing. I assumed that my charge as an artist, as a Black artist, was to champion the plight of Blacks, and to me that meant pointing out the sins of whites and the horrors of white treatment and of racism. So I spent a lot of time in my first stories talking about white oppression and how we had been so demoralized and defeated by whites that our lives were miserable. It was victimhood narratives, and what McPherson wanted me to see was that African Americans are anything but victims. That we have spent centuries overcoming mistreatment. And he wanted me to talk more about the heroic nature of African Americans and not talk about the aspects of Black life that are stereotypes and in fact were contrary to my very life. Otherwise, I would not have made it out of that community.
You said you thought you were following what your charge was as a Black artist. What do you see your charge is as a Black artist now?
My charge now, and McPherson made this clear to me, was to move beyond the stereotypes that plague African Americans and see what I can present to readers that will in some way have us focus on the things that unite us, on our universal values, on the things that make us all members of the human race and not simply in these separate categories that make it easy for people to have enemies and opposition.
Anger is kind of a presence to me as a reader in this book. You write about it in a few of the essays. It's a real double-edged sword for you. How do you think about anger now, your anger, the anger we're living with in 2020, and how do you grapple with it as an artist?
I've been known to get angry. I mean, anyone who reads the collection, in fact, we just spoke about it when McPherson did what he did in my workshop. I blew my top. I mean, I was a 20-something-year-old kid who stormed into the office of the first Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction as an African-American in this country's history. If that's not an example of someone who's got an anger problem, I don't know what is. So I do get angry, but the other side of my anger, and this is also something McPherson wanted me to focus on, is a sense of humor. And African Americans have always drawn on their sense of humor to get through difficult times. And so what I wanted to do in the collection was to find a way to combine the tragedy of life with the comedy of life and also talk about some pretty tough issues, but find a way to have it go down more easily. And I think humor is the way to do that.
Let's have you read something. I'm going to ask you to read a section from the essay Breathe. It deals with anger a bit. It deals with race. It deals with your kids who really feature in your essays. I wonder if you could read a bit for us.
Sure. One cause of your son's seizure, the doctor says, could be syphilis. Ask what's the basis for such speculation, given that no physical exam was conducted, no blood work drawn, no urine sample taken, and that your son, who was lying on the hospital bed before you looking bewildered, is 12. Obviously, it's not unheard of for 12-year-olds to have this disease, she responds, which is impossible for you not to hear as, you're Black, so I shouldn't have to tell you this. But it is possible, apparently, not to lose your temper. Be grateful for the article you read last month about the benefits of breathing exercises in times of high stress, because the one you're doing now is actually working. Before speaking, take another deep breath, followed by a slow exhale, focusing all the while on the air passing through your lungs. There. Now tell your family it's time to leave. Marvel at the calmness of your voice and wish you'd discovered this exercise years ago, long before your high blood pressure and reputation for being angry. Pat your son's shoulder as you nudge him upright. Take him home.
That's Emerson College Professor of Creative Writing Gerald Walker reading from the essay Breathe in his new collection, How to Make a Slave. Professor, what happened next in that story? That happened in your life. What happened next?
It is a true story. We took my son home, and I managed to leave the hospital without blowing my top. It was not easy, but I did it, thanks to my breathing exercises. We went home, and my son had another seizure, and so we decided not to take him back to the original hospital. We drove him into Boston, and we went to Boston Children's Hospital, where he ultimately was diagnosed as having a neurological disorder that causes adolescents to seize when they are thrust into motion. So whenever he starts to move very quickly, he'll have a seizure. It's a rare disease. We were thankful to have an answer for why it was happening, but it is pretty much harmless and it's controlled with medicine, and we're told that he'll grow out of it in his early 20s.
So he's okay now?
He is okay. He's still on medication, but it will pass.
So one of the things that's striking about that moment and that essay is it is both an iconic human moment, right? Whether one relates to it as a parent or if one has faced discrimination, whether one relates to it there. But it's also really a Boston moment because you're both facing this racism that Boston is known for, but also you can drive into town and receive some of the best health care in the world. You seem to allow the complexity of Boston to appear in your essays without focusing on it. Is Boston a character here? And is it a character in your own life experience?
No, I would have to say. But Boston is on the periphery of these stories. A lot of these stories, especially the ones that involve my kids, the settings are secondary. I simply happen to be in a place. But the primary focus for me in these pieces is often my family, usually myself. And I'm simply trying to make it through some stressful situations unscathed and to make sense of the senselessness that life often presents itself to be.
When I finished the book, I thought, man, this book is unapologetic. And what I mean by that is it reads like a set of essays by a man who has experienced pushback all his life for who he is and is now telling the world a little bit of every corner of that life and saying, I am at peace with this man. You can think whatever the hell you want. I'm good. Are you a man at peace? These are not peaceful times.
I love that description.
Thank you.
I am a man at peace. I one of the things about being a personal essayist is that you, if you aren't at peace when you start writing personal essays, you will be by the time you finish, because the genre requires openness and honesty, and with openness and honesty comes judgment and sometimes criticism. And you have to be prepared for that. And if you aren't, you're writing in the wrong field. But I am prepared for it. I am at peace with who I am, or I would have continued to write fiction and hide behind that form rather than stepping from behind the veil and saying, this is who I am. This is what I believe. This is what I know. And people can either accept it or not, but I'm not going to shy away from sharing it.
What's next?
Well, that's a good question. I just sat down to start writing the new book, and I think it's going to be a sequel to this one, another collection of essays, and we'll see what I haven't covered that I can still cover with hopefully some humanity and some humor.
Well, I will be there for it. Gerald Walker is a professor of creative writing at Emerson College. His latest collection is How to Make a Slave and Other Essays. Professor Walker, thanks for the book, and thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
We all know that America evolved as a melting pot, and one place that that's most evident is in our food, especially in the ways that food from different cultures crosses over. I'm thinking about how at my Thanksgiving table we'll have my Nona's pork sausage dressing, but also homemade chocolate cream pie from my dad's side of the family. Food tells our history, and that history is passed down through the cooks in our own families. Those are the kinds of stories that Tony Tipton Martin hopes to bring to Boston and beyond as the new editor-in-chief of Cook's Country. The magazine and its public television show are part of the Boston-based America's Test Kitchen franchise, and Tipton Martin is the first person of color to lead an America's Test Kitchen publication as editor-in-chief. She's joining us now to talk more about her vision for Cook's Country, and she's going to take your calls. What's the story behind the food you cook or you grew up with? Are there things you're making this Thanksgiving to remind you of family heritage? Maybe those you won't be seeing this year? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Tony Tipton Martin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. I want to congratulate you on the new job, and I want to ask you what it's been like to be making this transition to a new job during a global pandemic.
It has been quite a exciting time. There's been lots going on for me personally. I was injured the 2 weeks before, I think it was, my start date. So, you know, I've been adjusting to stretching in between Zoom calls and onboarding. But the team has been fantastic. I couldn't have wished for a better experience as I have re-entered the editing phase of my work. They're just so gracious and open and willing to share all of the ins and outs of America's Test Kitchen. I'm really, really excited.
I should just ask you, are you okay now? Physically healthy? You doing all right?
I am. My therapist says that I'm progressing well. It's never fast enough. You know, I'd love to be outside on the trail again, but that's coming. So I'm able to do a little cooking, and that has been really gratifying. I was very concerned about just whether I'd even be able to put any of our favorites on the table. And it seems like a small thing, but you know, everybody's talking about that right now. We want to return to some sense of normalcy, and I certainly feel that too.
What's one of the favorites that you want to make sure you can put on the table, and why?
Well, I actually just posted on Instagram that I made my Grand Marnier spiked cranberry sauce between calls today.
You know, between calls?
Between calls today. It only takes, you know, 10 minutes of prep and 10 minutes to cook. So you're talking about a 20-minute investment, and the flavor is fantastic. For those who think that they aren't fans of cranberry sauce, maybe it's because they're choosing the one in the can. And so America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country have an assortment of adaptations for making the side dish really different. You can add maple syrup or whatever flavors inspire you. But my family has grown accustomed to the flavors of orange. And so, you know, for me, prepping for Thanksgiving occurs in stages. And I start with those things that can be made ahead and store well in the back of the refrigerator. And this is one of those dishes that we just, you know, we all look forward to.
We are talking to Toni Tipton Martin, the new editor-in-chief of Cook's Country, and we invite you to join the conversation. What are some of the recipes that represent your heritage, your history? What are some traditions in the kitchen and the power of food that are important to you? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Toni, you are truly a food historian, and I wonder how you want to bring that to building on or expanding Cook's Country, you know, around telling the American food history through more voices. Where are you going to put the spotlight that it hasn't been?
Well, I love that you framed your question that way, because America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country are already known for their impeccable recipes, reliability, and the deliciousness of the dishes that we inspire cooks to try at home. And among the, the philosophies that we hold is that we will tell the stories behind those dishes. And in a lot of ways, that has meant explaining to you how the dish came to be in terms of the techniques and the methodology and the substitutions one might make to inspire cooks to become more competent in the kitchen. And what I want to do is build on that reputation by inspiring you to cook, by learning more about the people behind the foods that are our beloved favorites. And so you can expect to see more faces in the magazine. We're going to really talk to cooks, learn more about what tools they love, what some of their favorite ingredients are. And maybe we won't ask them a question at all, really. We'll just be nostalgic for those times when we're together in the kitchen cooking side by side with a loved one. And you're just there working together. And I hope that portraits of great cooks, great American cooks, will create that same kind of atmosphere for people in their kitchens when they take our magazine and our programming with them into the kitchen.
You have focused in the past on untold stories of our American food history. Your book, Jubilee, which focuses on Black food history in America, and the Jemima Code, which spotlights forgotten Black cooks, including those who served in white households. Can you place those histories in the overall American food story for us, especially people who didn't get recognition they deserved for being creators of parts of our food culture, but then erased from that story?
Oh, sure. You know, it's a tangled, complicated history. One of the most compelling stories in Jubilee and the book that preceded it, The Jemima Code, one of the stories comes from right there in the Boston area, right here, eventually I will be saying. But and this, the gentleman who was the author of this book was the house servant, the butler in the governor's mansion. And he produced it's a collection of recipes, but therefore an assortment of things, not just recipes for cooking, but also for managing a household, including things like how to remove flies from glass. But it's a fascinating study of the world of these people that we have portrayed as ignorant or not as proficient and competent as trained chefs. And yet they were working many times unsupervised and supervising others in the production of food in some of America's grand homes. And so I just love the fact that Robert Roberts penned this household servants guide as a love letter, really, to the next generation. Obviously, historians have complained that this was a book designed to just create more servants. And in the social context in which it was produced, that is certainly true. But if we can look beyond some of that and just extract the competencies and the passion for food and cooking and the care of others, a whole different story can be told. And that's the kind of beauty that I hope to bring to the pages of Cook's Country by shining a light on invisible American cooks as well.
I want to stay with some of your work on the history of food in America and the Black history of food in America. I want to play from some sound for you. In 2018, Radio Boston spoke to culinary historian Michael Twitty about caricatures like Aunt Jemima. Here he is.
We still have Aunt Jemima. We still have Uncle Ben. We still have the Cream of Wheat Man. We still have these embedded images of the power imbalance in the Old South based on food. The context is still there, but the material is there, but the context isn't. And so for me, a part of reapproaching our tradition was breaking down that wall, going, okay, this is not the reality.
So you, of course, wrote The Jemima Code. And then earlier this year, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times discussing this decision by Quaker Oats. They decided to retire the Aunt Jemima pancake mix and syrup brand, which is based on a caricature of Black cooks. And you talk about the real women like your own grandmother and the women in the Jemima Code, whose values and skills have been misrepresented by the Aunt Jemima image. Why have we held on to these images for so long? And are you showing us through that op-ed what you can do and will continue to do about a different form of sort of culinary storytelling?
Well, I can't really speak for why the industry holds on to those images, except to say that perhaps that explanation is rooted in the title, The Jemima Code, right? I recognized through the study of American food history that we've enjoyed a love-hate relationship with African-American cooks. And we've appreciated their competencies and then quickly disparaged them for some other, you know, level of incomplete knowledge. As a balance for provide, you know, for offering an expression of confidence in them, and that behavior has persisted throughout time. We've just, you know, two steps forward, three steps back in terms of our love hate relationship with Black people in general, which was why I was not an advocate initially of removing the image from the package, because I was concerned that would complete the erasure, that we would never talk about Aunt Jemima again, even as a fictitious character. I wanted there to be a further investigation into the real lives of African-American cooks before we dismissed the imagery. So I was pleased when when the decision was made, and someone much wiser than I posted on Twitter shortly thereafter that we don't need Aunt Jemima anymore because now we have the Jemima Code. And what that meant was a celebration of, at least in terms of the code, 150 new faces of real people that we can celebrate, we can study, we can learn from, we can learn to be better cooks and better human beings by our expression of fellowship at the table in their memory.
Let's talk about the stories behind recipes, and I'll start with one that you shared with us. You shared with us one pan turkey with herb stuffing and cranberry sauce, and we will have the recipe on our website at radioboston.org. Obviously a great Thanksgiving recipe. Is there a special story behind it?
There isn't a special story for me personally. The recipe resonates because so many people are sharing their anxiety about entering into this holiday without being able to put on the traditional gigantic spread with multiple side dishes and an enormous turkey and so on. And this is just a delightful alternative to that. It can be made in one pan. It still allows the family to enjoy those flavors that are so familiar and so comforting to us. But then it gives us a chance to talk perhaps about some other aspects of the day. You know, the word Thanksgiving is a two-part word. We often speak about being thankful, but we don't think about giving. And what I like about this idea of a truncated menu is that maybe we have resources that we can share with others, especially when we're seeing people lining up in food lines and going to community refrigerators. You know, the giving part can be achieved perhaps because we are spending less on that enormous spread that, frankly, registered dietitians have been trying to get us to cut back for years. And so I just really like that recipe for that reason. In my household, I will be taking advantage of a recipe from Jubilee. We haven't decided which one of the two we're going to do, but it will involve the Southwestern flavors, or maybe I'll just put the Southwestern flavors from Jubilee on that turkey breast.
So wait, what are the two candidates? You said there are two you're trying to decide between.
So the one is the recipe that we gave you. That's a Cook's Country recipe. You know, I'm doing a little dance right now because I'm living within two spaces. I'm promoting both dimensions of my work. And the really telling part about who I've been within the industry is, you know, kind of wrapped up in this Southwestern flavored turkey that we put on our menu a few years ago as a commemoration of our Southern California history and the fact that, you know, people often complain that turkey is dry, it's uninteresting, that's why we buy fried turkey. Some people smoke their turkeys. People have tried all kinds of ways to bring excitement to the centerpiece, but I, for one, was not willing to give up that gorgeous bird at the center of the table. So the men in my household wanted to fry it and, you know, add those Cajun flavors, but it's not very pretty. So yeah. The Southwestern flavors came natural to me and seemed like an alternative. And then at the table, we wound up talking more and more about our history. It was great.
So I'm afraid we have to stop there, but it's been a pleasure to have you. That's Toni Tipton Martin, Editor-in-Chief of Cook's Country, and I hope you come back again. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanksgiving is one of the most important days of the year for Daphne Lopes because it allows her to give. Many of us will have very little for the holiday, let alone an abundant feast. Having once stood in line to receive a free Thanksgiving turkey, Daphne now volunteers each year doing turkey distribution with Catholic Charities, an organization that I ran more than a decade ago. We talked with Daphne for the first time on Radio Boston last year as she was preparing for the big turkey distribution weekend. It was Such a different time then. She came into the studio. She was wearing a big stuffed turkey on her head. It's a hat that's made her famous on the turkey line. Well, this year is a new year. It's different. And we wanted to check in with her again now as part of our series, Living Through Corona. We caught up with Daphne Lopes earlier this afternoon, and I started by asking her how she's been faring in this difficult 2020.
I'm surviving like everyone else. We're taking it one day at a time, and we're doing the best that we can. But we're making it work.
Has the virus loomed large in your life like it has for so many people, Daphne?
This virus is taking a lot of loved ones from me. I don't like it, and it's taken some people from me that all I have left are memories. And I'm just trying to remember the good part and get rid of just 2020 and this virus and move on to a new day and some new hope.
I'm sorry for your losses, Daphne.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I know how important volunteering at Catholic Charities is for you, especially around the turkey distribution. And I know you get a turkey for volunteering, and you often give it away. Did you wind up giving away your turkey this year?
Turkey tradition, turkey given away again this year.
Who did you give it to?
I don't know the family that I gave it to. It was just someone in line that was in need of a turkey. I must say, Tiziana, just in the last year, in light of COVID, the need at Catholic Charities has been twice as much as normal. Clients that they're serving now are people that were financially set in what I call now the BC era, which was before COVID. And now these are clientele that are looking for services and they're trying to navigate. They have nowhere to go. They don't know how to navigate and find these services that others do.
What does it mean to you to be somebody who's serving others right now, Daphne?
I want to serve as many people as possible. I want to be able to sit down again this year with my meal and know that as many people as possible can sit down and have themselves a Thanksgiving meal. I had families this year that were unable to make it over to the turkey drive to pick up their meals. I brought home 22 baskets to my home, and I arranged for people to come to my home to pick them up, so that everyone could get the services that they needed this year.
What's in those baskets?
They have fresh vegetables, fresh potatoes. They have onions, carrots. They get cranberry sauce. They get stuffing. They get their turkey. They get the pan to cook the turkey in. And they get the best wishes that they can possibly get for a holiday meal from everyone who's serving them.
You talked about your own meal. What's Thanksgiving going to look like for you this year, and how will it be different than last year?
Thanksgiving this year will be different than last year because last year we talked about the family getting together and everyone bringing a portion of the meal and fellowshipping. This year, everyone will be in their own homes, and we've arranged to do a Zoom at a certain time so everyone can still sit down and have dinner together and fellowship, so we'll be together but separate.
Last year when we spoke, it was right before the weekend of the big turkey distribution in Dorchester. I know you did that this last weekend. Take us to the scene this year. How did it unfold? What would we have seen there in the morning? How did it work and what was different?
First thing that was different was I went there earlier on Friday. We all had masks on. Everyone has gloves on. We measured out 6 feet from Catholic Charities all the way down to the first cross street because we figured that that's how long the line usually is. I had my mask on. I had my famous turkey hat on. My turkey hat had its mask on too. We had to be socially safe as well.
I want you to know, I love your turkey hat so much. We have one at our house, and I want you to know I am wearing my turkey hat under my headset while we have this conversation. But now I feel like I missed something because I don't have the mask on it.
My turkey had to be socially right this year.
That's fantastic. I'll have to add a mask to my turkey hat. Did the line stretch as long? You put these red X's out. You're anticipating what the need is going to be. I know you already said some people couldn't come to the distribution site. Did the line stretch as long as you thought it would?
Actually, it didn't this year. When they passed out tickets, they actually gave clientele a certain time period or time slot to come and to be served. And what they did differently this year is people were showing up at 6 o'clock, and to try to keep lines from being so long, they started serving people at 6 o'clock in the morning. I know at the Haitian Multicultural Center, by the end of the business day on Saturday, they had given out over 2,500 turkeys. By the end of the business day yesterday, just the Greater Boston Catholic Charities had served over 4,000 families.
That's there a is lot so of people. Much. It is, Daphne. You know, we talked about this last year. You told me about a family that you had come in contact with, that you'd given your turkey to last year, and that what had inspired that was, I think the previous year, a woman who had told you that she had had to eat dog food on Thanksgiving because she was not able to get food from the pantry. And I remember how heartbroken you were by that. Were there any families you met this year that really stayed with you or whose stories are really sticking with you?
I think that the one that just stuck with me the most was a young lady that walked up the street to get her turkey, and she had walked so long and so far that she could barely breathe when she got there. She had to sit on the stairs for the longest time and wait for arrangement. They thought that she was having a problem with her heart. You know, that just really bothered me, that people are walking from such a distance because they don't even have the money to get on the bus just to travel to get the services. That's what's
was she
really
okay in the end?
To me. She was okay. It's just the distance that she had to walk and the age of the client that was being served.
Did she have to carry her food back that distance again, Daphne?
No. We sat with her and the directors of the program, and they did arrange for someone to come and pick her up. That's the heart that Catholic Charities has, and that's where I find my hope.
And that's Catholic Charities volunteer Daphne Lopes. Daphne, thanks for joining us again this Thanksgiving.
I'm sending a virtual hug to you and everyone connected to this line and to this organization. Please check back in with me next year and every year. I would love to tell you the difference between this year and next year, because I'm hoping for a difference next holiday season.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening today, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.